Welcome to this episode of the Spinoza Triad. After a break of a few weeks in which Richard has managed to catch COVID again, Dan continues to work hard, and I have, well, made a short promotional appearance on Live from America. Find the link on our website. This episode, we discuss Squid Game. Actually, we recorded this a short while ago. We recorded it when the Squid Game was a big thing and the most popular series on Netflix, which I still think it holds that title. For us, the Squid Game is an interesting metaphor, which we can apply both ideas on philosophy, but particularly the ideas of Marx. Well, is it simply more or less than a Marxist metaphor? Well, let's discover. I think we find there's more to it than that.
Popular Netflix series ever.
But is it? Is it the most popular ever?
The question is why? Why is it so popular?
I mean, regardless of any sort of analysis of it, if you're just watching it, it's well written, it's exciting.
It's disturbing.
You want to keep watching them. But do you think the violence is much like the V for Vendetta violence, where it's almost caricatured?
It's like comic book violence, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's not intimate violence, is it? It's kind of like pastiche.
There's a rather clinical dispatching of people. I mean, fortunately, I've no idea. I'm not au fait with the technicalities of shooting someone in the head. But I'm assuming they don't all instantly drop to the ground in an executed manner. I'm guessing they could be.
It'd be a bit more messy, I'd imagine.
It could be there's the splash. There's the sort of splash of blood, and that's the sort of ubiquitous in those sort of violence these days, isn't it? Because bloosh, explosion. But there's not screaming and agony and stuff.
There's a lot of fear, though, especially in that in the first game when they're running towards that demonic doll. They suddenly realised that this is life and death. They thought it was the game before. They didn't quite know where it was going, and then suddenly the realisation when that guy runs forward, hit with an automatic rifle. Everyone suddenly realises there's something afoot here, and then they realise the conditions of their new situation.
I mean,
that was quite well done, I thought.
It makes a game of competition, doesn't it? Obviously, we're going to at some point talk about its relationship to capitalism and anti-capitalism.
There is a straight-up critique of capitalism in the same sense as Parasite. And I think it's very interesting that Korean context of what's happening to Korean society, we could talk about. But also, I think the two films have a lot in common. There's class, privilege, inequality, the arbitrary nature of capitalism. Both films explore that. Some people are rich, some are poor. Some people succeed, some don't. It's not based on talent. It's not based on effort. Capitalist society is a society of chance and random luck.
I'm gonna challenge that, John. I think it's a critique of meritocracy. I think that throughout the games in Squid Games, the emphasis is always that everyone, that the games are fair, that everyone starts from an equal playing field and doesn't take into consideration people's aptitudes and abilities. And that's the nature of meritocracy that perhaps was challenged in 2008 with the financial crisis. But that was our way of going on throughout the 80s and 90s, that everything's fair because everyone should have an equal chance, whether they make use of it or not, that's their moral responsibility. So that meritocracy was a challenge to the old class structure of the Victorian period up to the mid-20th century. And you could say that Squid Games is criticising that because it devolves the human from everything. It becomes a machine.
I completely agree with you. I think meritocracy is one of those fantasies. We talked last podcast about the kind of fantasy that hides the reality. And I think the meritocracy is always often wheeled out to, work hard, a reward society that rewards the hardworking. That's not the principal characteristic of capitalism. Meritocracy is often the sort of shop window, but the reality of capitalism is chance, privilege, corruption, accident. These are much more features, and they're all not meritocratic at all.
Exploitation.
I mean, take that first scene, the red light, green light.
Yeah.
The organizers of the game don't tell the people, look, this is about life and death. So they walk out onto that curiously banal-looking pitch, and there's a doll up ahead, and they're laughing. You know, they characterize, there's two characters who are dispatched quite quickly, who are sort of joking around with each other. You know, I'll get ahead of you, I'll win, you know, bet you can do this. And there's and they're quite childish, and they see a childish game, and they behave childishly in it. And as they don't take it at all seriously. And they die, naturally enough, because they don't know it's a life or death situation, they die. Anyone in the front of that crowd or in that first game happened to not know, they all don't know. So it randomly kills. So some quickly realize that it's life or death, but most don't. They all flee back to the doors where they're horribly massacred.
Mm.
So there's an arbitrary and excessive violence element. Doesn't presuppose that, you know, if you play by the rules, you'll win. You don't know the rules.
But the violence is part of the game.
Yeah.
That's the critique of capitalism, because we often sanitize the violence that we that are imbued in the choices that we make. We forget that every choice we make has a possible violent outcome. But we don't see, or there is such a thing as economic violence.
Yeah.
And we put things like meritocracy in the way of it to make this violence seem necessary and part of the structure of things that we all just have to accept, to the point we forget about it.
And what about the very fact it is a game? Oh, I mean, the competition is, it's kind of a, the very fact it's played out as, you know, we say the word game to assume it's sort of enjoyable, but it's not overly enjoyable, is it really? I mean, people are dying in it. It kind of normalizes that, doesn't it, as well?
Well, that is the collision between the fantasy and the reality, which might be a critique of our society, fantasy-reality difference. You're right. We live in a meritocratic world. We're very liberal. We have a lot of freedom. And Dan, you're saying there, but actually that masks a degree of economic violence, a degree of environmental violence, which is the left-hand side of capitalism. If the right-hand side of capitalism is opportunity, the left-hand side is violence and criminality.
Yeah, it might be the right hand is violence and left hand is the other. Left and right.
Left's always the bad. Sinister, Dexter, sinister, isn't it? Dexter is right.
If you're taking
sinister
from a
is left.
Viewpoint. Okay, yeah, okay.
That's where you get the word sinister from. Sinister, the left side is sinister.
Right, yeah. Because it's challenging the system. What do we think about the dehumanising nature of it, though? The masks. Buko and surveillance.
Yes.
Everyone's wearing a mask. Everyone's playing a role. As soon as you take the mask off, you suddenly are confronted again with our perennial theme, the real, not the fantasy. You're suddenly not playing the game when the mask comes off. And all the staff who are facilitating these horrendous games are all wearing these awful masks with little squares or triangles on.
Yeah.
So it's dehumanizing them. They're just part of the system. So could we bring a bit of Foucault into this, where, you know, surveillance and control, everything's being watched, everyone else is watching everyone else, and fundamentally the viewer of Squid Games is the fundamental viewer, in a kind of Foucault's way of looking at things there, you know, in terms of surveillance.
I agree. I mean, he's the series itself is about surveillance, isn't it, and how people regulate themselves. That's the key point, isn't it? Where they regulate themselves within a system. They're given a kind of illusion of choice. I mean, it's a forced choice. You know, you can leave the games if you want, but they're only leaving the games to go back into the very kind of inherent problems with this, I'd say, with capitalism. You know, you've got some gambling problem, you've got one mixed up with criminality, you've got, each one has a separate narrative, which is itself a product of that. I feel there's the obvious Foucault examples, aren't there, with the cameras and the surveillance. Mm. I was just thinking there, what you said about the guards, though, Dan, you were saying about the guards, because I thought it was an interesting point there was, again, if we stick with this kind of the capitalist idea or the critique of capitalism, that the guards themselves are largely, you know, one of them gets shot, doesn't he, you know, for not conforming. I mean, they are themselves a product of surveillance. Yes. And the sort of Marxist point about of sort of false consciousness of the players in the game, but also the bourgeois owners of the games. They seem bored and not engaged. They're using other, you know, human bodies as furniture, and they seem victim of the games. I mean, not as much, obviously, because they're not being killed, but at the same time, there's a kind of element there where they're not, or maybe that is their true selves, they're not achieving. There's a sort of ideological dimension there to the people.
Well, that's interesting you should say that, because it clearly is a massively organized game. However, they're doing this organization, have got colossal amounts of money, organization, warehouses, and so on. They are a big organization. And the end result is some fat blokes sitting in a rather dodgy and loose sort of room, seeing some people killed and betting on it. I mean, the end result is so banal. There is no, you know, they're not.
That's the point.
Conducting some great experiment themselves.
And also, one thing we should say is that they're all wearing masks as well. And the only time that the rich billionaires one of them looks vulnerable is obviously when his mask is taken off and he's facing his imminent demise. So it's this whole mask wearing, that this capitalist view that we have, that everyone's playing roles. No one's embracing their humanity. They're turning themselves into numbers.
We're made subjects,
and not being real subjects, to their own existence. They're just accepting the number that the system has given them. The people with power, the people who are orchestrating these games, are still wearing a mask. You know, those horrible, the golden piglet he was wearing, the guy who was about to be killed, has to take his mask off, looking very vulnerable and pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, there is, besides a critique of capitalism, there's a critique of violence, the nature of violence. It's not a million miles away from the Zimbardo prison or Milgram, or is it Milgram and Zimbardo and the Stanford prison experiment. Yeah. That thought that gives someone a mask and they become a guard, give someone else a jumpsuit and they become a prisoner. What is the difference between the guards and the prisoners? When the guard reveals himself and they're all trying to steal, they're harvest, there's a group of them harvesting organs, isn't there? And they are clearly sort of subcontracting but harvesting the organs actually would be a higher form of criminality than actually what is revealed. The actual criminality is amusement. You know, the big organization itself is for amusing and gambling. It's just banal. Whereas the sub criminals, at least they've got some sort of productive, and someone's going to get these organs, presumably. Yeah. So if you get a harvested liver or whatever, then someone say, you know, you could argue there's a sort of actual purpose in the sub criminals. But what is the difference between the criminals and the guards? Where do these guards come from? I mean, there's a lot of them, and are they victims as well, or are they, you know, what separates them from, and that question of the innate violence that separates the victim and the guard in any of the situations of totalitarian regimes over the years, I think it is an exploration of the nature of violence.
But can you separate violence from capitalism, or are they the same thing? And the point, the only reason we can separate it is because it's sanitized and removed and turned into a game. And then we say, like government leaders say, well, this is just the rules of the game. There can't be any other way. It's just got to be.
That's the point, though, Dan. That's what I said earlier about the actual point of it being a game, because it's how it's narrated to us, isn't it? When you're at school, you know, you're telling, you know, if you're teaching children, you know, they're being told they're being told rules to a game, basically, aren't they? But they're told it's careers, and it's the game. I mean, a point, again, it's largely down to the Mark Fisher book, which I mentioned last week, Capitalist Realism. But here's a section in that called Reflexive Impotence. And it's the way in which, you know, students...
I've been watching Channel 4 lately. Like, these things keep coming up going, erectile dysfunction?
I don't want to know you've been watching, John.
Channel 4, you know. the kind of advert that I was watching it with my mum, you know, sort of, you know, oh dear. Anyway, sorry.
Wait a minute. You throw my thought there. I was going to make some profound point, John. Reflexive impotence. He makes the point. It's reflective definitely impotent. Worth reading. Reflexive.
No, you did. You said reflective.
Reflexive impotence. Yeah. Just how, you know, students know that they know the game, the rules they're playing under is a game. They know that they're being trained. They know that, there are certain things you have to do, but all the same, nobody does anything about it. And that's really his point in the book, that capitalism has become so ingrained now. But along with it is this realization that it is all of the ills, all the problems that go with it. But any viable alternative is incredible. We don't even question it. So he goes through culture and education and, a number of politics and he talks about it. But the point that he made there, I feel like maybe something like Squid Games is making a overt point about the problems of capitalism. But all the same, we kind of know this, but we just carry on with it, and the contradictions to the issues there. So, like I say, the gambling guy, the guy with the gambling problem, the criminal one, there are certain pathologies within it that are seen as reasons why they've had to enter the game. But what it does quite well, I think, is maybe show that how they're actually inherent to the system itself, that you can't get away from it. But it removes the option of actually eradicating the entire thing to start again.
I think where that is revealed in a way is the one of the cleverest things in the narrative is that, first of all, you think these people are sort of coerced into this situation by their own, massive debt or difficult life or desperation or brain tumor, the old guy. You think, well, you've found yourself in this. And then they're given the opportunity to leave. And indeed, they do leave.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But most of them, the vast majority, come back again.
Yeah.
As you say, it's the willing.
That's the point, isn't
impotence,
it?
Impotence, as it were. The willingness. What else can I do?
But also that the contradiction is within the story. It's in it. It's within it. So the contradictions within capitalism, they're hardwired into it. Like I say, it's within the story itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And throwing a bit of Zizek and Lacan here with the real and the fantasy. Could you say there's a moment when those ideas come to the fore, when right at the end, the policeman is trying to get a signal on his mobile phone to tell the reality of this game to the world, and he's not able to get a signal. So he's climbing up to the mountaintop to get a signal out to say, look, this is what's actually going on, guys. And obviously there's no signal to broadcast the message. So is that the same thing? We're saying that there is no alternative, that the game is all, and we can't imagine anything else, and we can't broadcast anything else except what this game actually is. It's because his phone's not working. His phone can't get that message out. So we can't see anything other than what we know.
Yes.
Well, it's when capitalism itself is. You've got a TV show, the most popular Netflix, who I imagine is the most popular viewing thing. Is it now? I don't know. But then you've got the most popular show on there. It's almost saying, it's giving you a narrative of the problem of capitalism itself, which you're already in. It's almost, it places the viewer within a certain position there as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's one of those awkward kind of paradoxes, is that often popular culture in our capitalist society is a critique of capitalism. So we often sit down. I mean, I saw a film called The Platform. It was complete, pure Marxism. It was a Spanish film about this platform that rises up and down through multiple layers.
I saw that as well, John. I thought it was fantastic. With the people at the bottom getting the scraps at the bottom.
And the violence in that is full on. I mean, that is a more horrifying violence, I thought.
Oh, it was horrendous, wasn't it? It was an awful film to watch, but it was so engrossing as well.
People are placed on a platform and the food, the people at the top eat the luxurious food. And as it goes down, there's less and less food and the people at the bottom are horribly starving. Well, it's straight up Marxism. So you're sitting there watching this, think, I'm enjoying the movie that's making the money in a system of mass communication that is capitalistic, which is a critique of capitalism. It's like listening, it's the song Down With Capitalism, but can I buy the t-shirt Down With Capitalism? Yeah, you can.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, in a similar, just stay on that Mark Fisher point. He's a, for me, a relatively newly discovered guy. You know, I've only recently come across him. I really like his stuff. But there's another book which I've got recently. I've skimmed little bits of it, but it's by a guy called Mike Watson, and it's called the Meming of Mark Fisher, and it's really about how he became a meme. Mark Fisher did it himself, and he takes a sort of Frankfurt School account of that. But it's a bit like that, isn't it? It's a similar kind of thing. Again, capitalism itself it appropriates. I think that's the point that he's trying to make with the book.
Oh yeah, for a long time. Yeah. If you want to sell a T-shirt, in Camden Market, put Che Guevara on front of it. Like hotcakes.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a contradiction, isn't it?
And also, it's a symbol that's devoid of its meaning. It's just, you know, but it means something else.
That's a good point. Yeah,
it just becomes detached. I mean, from the rebellion.
That point you're making there, Dan, about the real. I mean, I haven't thought about it in Lacanian terms. Is this sort of fantasy and real kind of relationship with this? But you know, it's I guess the kind of critique of that is that the job of ideology is to present itself as objective truth. You know, outside of it, you know, an ideology doesn't say I'm an ideology. An ideology is a group of statements that present themselves as objective. You know, this is the way it is.
Just that people live by.
But so it's so ingrained everywhere that just trying to have the conceptual tools to think outside of the dominant ideology. That, you know, and part of the freedom of choice is largely an illusion. The choice that you have, it's within the story itself, the choice of leaving, but you can't. That's the ideology is the illusion that you can think outside of it. You can't.
Perfect. Yeah, that's exactly true. Yeah. Yes. But I mean, could we say is the Squid Games entirely just a kind of a bleak criticism of capitalism, or is it perhaps, you know, saying that there's something more, and does it end on an optimistic note or
as you know, Dan, note? I got drunk and fell asleep. And
well, I don't want to.
I was awoken by my daughters, but to the ending of it, Dad.
But obviously, John's going to say lots of spoilers ahead. But I mean, The last scene, when we find that the old man we've been sympathetic with throughout the whole set of episodes, is actually the guy behind the whole game, and he's sitting there on his hospital bed, and Ji Hun, our hero, confronts him, and he just says, "The reason I put it forward, he's obviously another one of these billionaires. He's just so bored with life. He wanted to have that kick of adrenaline." And he is a very misanthropic guy. He thinks people are horrendous and horrible. And Ji Hun says, "I don't think that. I think people are still good. In spite of the games, in spite of all that goes on, he still thinks people are good." And the last scene is when he sees a drunk man collapsed on the street corner just outside his hospital bed. And they place a kind of bet to say, "Look, if someone helps him, then I'm wrong. But if no one comes to help him, the Squid Games continue." And of course, someone does come to help him. Is it an optimistic view to say, from the guys that put this
pure
this
Marxism, together, isn't it?
Yeah, no. Is it saying
it is
that we can actually, once we realise the nature of the game, can we realise our essential humanity and stop seeing ourselves as numbers and, you know, bits in a cog of a machine that's destroying our humanity? I think I found the ending to be quite optimistic. And then the guy obviously setting up the next series is going to devote all the money he won to unraveling the game. I think that's the plot line I'd imagine would be the next, series.
They've left it open.
Isn't that the Marxist point though?
It is quite Marxist. It's like a revolution against the system. Yeah.
And as we said, you know, Marx's point was that the ruling class were suffered from, you know, false consciousness as much as the working class do. So maybe it's unveiling of the truth to him.
Yeah,
I guess the second part would have to be a classless society. When it sounds quite boring already, doesn't it? I mean, how are they going to make part two? I just don't know. You know.
Trying to get people not to go into the game. Trying to Ji Hoon will be spending his time hanging around, you know, the suburbs of Seoul. The tube network of Seoul, telling people not to talk to people, offering them a quick game of cards or something.
Yes, well, he does. He saves that one guy, doesn't he? He tells him to get lost, and then.
Yeah,
he takes his card and he phones him. But the thing is, I mean, when a thing is progressing like that, a series of, you know, the villains of the vastly powerful, even the policeman who manages to get himself in, integrate, you know, to infiltrate the game, is eventually
can't get his message out.
He's either killed or probably not killed. Who knows? He jumps into the sea, which is a surefire.
Oh no! Hold on. One thing we should say is the policeman is actually the brother of the organizer of the game.
The main facilitator of the games. Yes, the front man. Yeah. But anyway,
the warring brothers. There's an archetype there as well, isn't there?
When he pulls the mask off, and he says, you're my brother." It's a touch of the. Darth Vaderishness. I'm your father, you know. Kind of, oh, right, you're my brother. So there's no escape. I was trying to rescue you, and now you're turn out to be the bad guys, and I'm going to jump in the sea, so maybe I can come back in the future. They're very difficult to end a series like that. I mean, how do you bring it to an end? I think there was a little bit of either you end it very bleakly, and you know they all get killed or something like that, or the villains get away, or so they've left it open enough that he might come back and unmask them in the future. But how do you end it? And I think they did try to end it on a sort of little moral, maybe necessary moral message, which within this world of capitalism and cruelty and violence, there isn't, as you say, Dan, a humanity that persists. There's the two girls, the one from the North Korea and the one who's the other girl. And she, they form a friendship, and one sacrifices her life to save the other one.
Yeah.
And indeed, and the old man, he says he knows that the other guy's cheating at the marbles game, and lets him win and go ahead. You know, the old man knows he's not going to be killed, but effectively spares him in a game constructed with ruthless violence. There's little bits of humanity, and then they have this little bet. They say, look across the road there. There's an old guy freezing in the street and all that stuff. They say, well, is that? I've proved to you. What have you proved? I mean, actually, it's a bit of a one-sided game that you've proved. So in this world of mass, organized, pernicious violence that you've just created, this world, there's a little bit of humanity now and again. Well, okay.
I think that's the essential message. That's how I see it anyway. That was my takeaway of the whole set of episodes. It was quite optimistic at the end.
Well,
do you agree? I don't know.
Well, you agree if you believe that the act of non-violence is more profound than the act of violence.
Yeah,
that moral argument about non-violence versus violence as a form of resistance, is the moral high ground more powerful? Is the good more profound than evil in the sense that?
But the good is within sort of micro moments of agency for the characters within the plot, which is almost hopelessly controlled by external forces or by. That's to me. I mean, I felt like I said I didn't see the last episode, but what's the artist with the stairs? Is it Escher?
Escher, yeah.
You have that kind of same thing, don't you, with the stairs going up, and they don't know if they're going up or down or around. They have little bits of choice where they can try and help someone a little bit. You're kind of screwed. There's a massive system you can't get past.
Yes.
But there's a small moments where you might do something. You know, again, it goes back to that kind of impotence that Fisher's talking
until
about.
Until the whole structure comes tumbling down, yes, that you can only express your humanity momentarily.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, because you did have moments of humanity in the series where, you know, the other one was when the guy who was desperate to survive actually let his wife die and then felt so appalling and
kills himself.
And then hung himself because he felt so guilty. Even that was a moment of humanity. He was willing, the day before, he was wanting to survive at all costs. And then he realised that survival meant nothing when he'd let his wife die. So that was quite a humane moment. And also the guy who was the kind of the gang leader, the ruthless one, you know, he was seen as rather as a pastiche. He was quite an empty character. So yeah, so I think the whole thing was imbued with humanity, but it is a huge cost.
It is that humanity. Well, it is the asking that question, though, isn't it? It's a bit like the last trip I did was to go to Krakow and Auschwitz.
Right.
And I thought, oh, don't I go to Auschwitz, really? Before this trip, I thought, well, I'm a bit worried when I get there, it'll be sort of concentration camp land. You know, there'll be lots of moral messages and a sense of, I don't know, it'll be a constructed tourism out of monumental suffering. I don't want to be a tourist. I don't think this place is quite up for tourism, isn't right for tourism. But when I got there, actually, it was so brilliantly, the guides were different to any guide I've ever come across. They were sort of deeply moved themselves, almost. It's almost as if they had a mission to tell this story. And one of the stories they tell is of a religious guy who's in Auschwitz. And one day he volunteers to take the place of someone else to be executed. And he's like, oh, my God.
What's his name?
I've forgotten his name.
I know his name.
And he just steps in front, you know, take him
the
rather than
me.
The
Saint of Auschwitz,
The Saint of Auschwitz. And you think, well, in the end, where are the Nazis now? They're gone. And they were always going to go. It was a regime of stupidity and violence. It made no sense economically. It made no sense scientifically. Had the Nazis beaten Russia, they wouldn't still be here today. They wouldn't last long. The Soviet Union's gone. And if you know any, you know, Putin's Russia makes no sense. It's corrupt and it's inefficient. And so in the end, violence and dictatorship and totalitarianism has no future. And it may be the message. Well, what I'm trying to say is, I guess what I'm going around the corner into is the small act of dignity and mercy and humanity more powerful in the end. And that's what prevails.
That, I think, is the message of Squid Games. Yeah, great point, John. And even it all seems so bleak and so violent, and why are we sitting through this? And then, yeah, you get that kind of message to say that, that there is something more.
Yeah.
That was my viewpoint when I watched.
I think there's another dimension. Now, you mentioned sort of the Nazis there and Squid Games and the kind of the if you think about the reality of carrying out, if you're a guard within that scenario, so it's you're basically shooting people that think they're in a game. You know, the psychoanalytic point there of enjoyment. You know, it's not pleasure, it's an enjoyment, it's almost like a pleasure in pain. Within something like the Nazi ideology, it wasn't just a banality of evil, of people just carrying out mundane jobs, or the idea with Eichmann was that he was just some bland business facilitator. In actual fact, there's a level of enjoyment there at the kind of fetishization of the very structure itself. Data and numbers and uniforms and everything was carried out to the letter. You see the same thing in schools in some respects, you know, the way in which bureaucracy is carried out, and there's a form of enjoyment even if the bureaucracy and the structure itself is wrong, there's a pleasure in it. It doesn't matter that the outcome's wrong. And I wonder that the Squid Games, you know, is there a level there whereby the very running of the games itself is seen, you said about the uniforms earlier, Dan, everything's immaculate, the system itself is running efficiently. There's a the jouissance is a the sort of psychoanalytic term for it. There's a level of enjoyment, which isn't just, it's not just that things will be as they are or the banality to it. It's a change of the accent, maybe.
Why is that joy there to begin with? What is the joy?
It's not a joy. It's not joy. A pleasure of pain. It's a form of enjoyment. What? Economy. It's an economy of satisfaction. But okay, not a nice. It's like a, you know, someone that tortures themselves with diets and the gym and other stuff. But it's the economy of the pleasure in the pain. And I think that bureaucracy works like that.
Is that masochism? Sorry. Sort of masochism, sadism, a sort of...
Yeah, I think that's slightly different again, because that's a more extreme version of it. I think it's, if you take someone that takes the letter of the law within a bureaucratic system, a Jobsworth, someone that just takes the policy to its extreme, regardless, finds an enjoyment in the implementing that policy. That would be an example of...
Is that because it gives them a sense of self-justification for their existence? So they justify themselves through the system.
Well, that's a rational choice. I think this is more an almost an emotive feeling.
Okay.
I think that's the point. It's a satisfaction in the system itself, which makes you feel...
Because that's interesting, because we were saying earlier that one of the curious things about this violence in Squid Game, is it's not particularly sadistic in the sense that no one is being horribly tortured, of them all laughing as they try to cross that glass bridge. But there's an enjoyment in the violence, but it's curiously non-gratuitous, the violence. It's very systematic. If you break the rule, you die. If you don't break the rules, you don't die.
So I'm thinking of the mate. What's the character called? He's got like a mask on, but it's not like the others. He's the front man. The way in which he implements the laws and the regulation, and everyone sort of buys into it. And it's I wonder if Squid Games is kind of a comment on that. It's a faceless. Well, it's a faceless bureaucratic procedure.
Also, it's its own morality, isn't it? It constructs its own morality. When they catch the sort of subcontracting criminals, the ones who've been selling organs, they kill them and they hang their bodies up and they say, look, here you go. These people broke the rules and this is very offensive to us. And we're very sorry this happened to... They apologise to the poor old punters. We're very sorry. This is unfair. They shouldn't have been doing this. We're killing you according to the rules. But killing you not according to the rules, or rather disobeying the rules is outrageous. In the film No Country for Old Men.
Oh, it's a brilliant film.
The psychopath. Yeah. That's the word I'm after. If ever there was a psychopath patrol. The psychopath in that. He's been talked about by the other hitman, the Woody Harrelson character. And he says, look, he's actually one of the most moral people you could meet. He's got a tremendous sense of his own morality. And he has that awful sadistic game where he flicks the coin. And he asks the old guy in the roadhouse or the garage to flick a coin. He says, and the guy realizes... See, I'm in front of a psychopath here. I have a horrifying suspicion that if I get the wrong side of this coin, I'm going to die. And that, indeed, what's going to happen? He's asked this guy to momentarily gamble for his life. And you think, well, why is that? And it's because he's imposed on the world some sort of arbitrariness, which if things don't turn out right for you, then you must suffer the consequences.
Mm. And satisfaction in that would be the sort of enjoyment of it, wouldn't it? The jouissance of it, the satisfaction in the rules themselves and how that, I mean that's interesting you say that, John. I think it was Himmler, wasn't it, who called himself a Kantian, that he was he thought of himself as an ethical person because he narrated the sort of Nazi ideology of look at the hardship that we must go through in order for greatness. So he saw it as something that, in a very twisted kind of way, perspective is, I think, reinforced with this idea of a form of enjoyment.
I think you're right. I think Eichmann at his trial said something along the lines of, the rules are the rules and I had to carry out the rules. And
that's
the moral thing to do.
Yeah, and it's that pleasure and pain. I know these rules could be seen as not, but look what we must go through in order for the greater good. And I must implement these rules no matter what and take a kind of satisfaction or enjoyment within them. And it's that dark economy of pleasure in pain.
Yeah, and that ghastly quality, the stern parent, the stern Victorian father who's about to thrash his child and says, this hurt me more than it hurts you. Well, no, it won't. Obviously can't possibly. But no, it will.
Yeah. It's exactly that, yeah.
Yeah, so how does that relate to the critique of capitalism then?
I just, in a very regimented way, I mean, bureaucracy works, doesn't it? If we were to say that 85% of the world's population are in poverty, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor is growing with all the environmental problems which it causes as well. I mean, but we all know that. But, you know, it exists because there's a system running, because at every level, at an institutional level, people are conforming to bureaucratic processes which are having a detrimental effect, but we still carry them out. And I guess that enjoyment is just, it's not all that you are being told to do it, therefore you must. There is a level of a strange kind of enjoyment within that, in the process itself, which people engage in. I'm not saying all people all the time, but there's definitely, you know, you don't have to work in education to see middle management, the way they act, you know, with these new ideas that you think, you can't really believe that, do you? And everyone, members of staff that are sat watching middle management, they're all thinking the same thing. You know, you don't really believe this, but we go along with it anyway.
And then because we go along with it, we're propping up the system of this continuation of dehumanization of our existences.
And there is the sort of odd human quality that we have of happiness in other people's pain. I mean, curiously,
happiness in our own pain, John. That's the point with this. It's not happiness in the other's pain. It's happiness in our own pain. There's a satisfaction in the regime that we put. Yeah.
We're being masochistic in a way, and this is what props up the system.
Yeah, whether we just go ahead with it and take a form of enjoyment in all the paperwork and the bureaucracy and the administration. And I mean,
the moaning, again, I go back to working so hard. I've been working so hard. I've been, it's a long, hard week. All this kind of thing.
Hard work for what? For hard work. He works hard. Well, at what? Is he productive? Doesn't matter. He just works hard. And that's celebrated, you know, this kind of, that's another example, isn't it, of a form of enjoyment there.
Yes,
but it's not an enjoyment. It's not a pleasure. It's a pleasure in your own, it's an enjoyment in your own,
displeasure.
I use the word pain. Yeah, displeasure, yeah.
Yes, it's that kind of, I was thinking of the idea of the sort of undeserving poor, the way we are easily able to quite enjoy the misfortunes of others if they think they've brought it upon themselves. You know, they didn't work hard enough or they are, you know, that. But what you're saying there is that in capitalist society, people are actually able to sort of enjoy their own pain because there's a sort of deferred quality, a sacrifice. I'm sacrificing this for my children. I'm sacrificing this for the mortgage. I'm working all the hours God sends because that's what I should do. And even though I'm living a fairly miserable existence of quiet desperation, it is what I should be doing.
You could say
there's an enjoyment in the suffering. There's an enjoyment in the suffering. But it's not necessarily just for something that's coming in the future.
Yeah. I think to illustrate this in a very basic term, maybe there's an enjoyment in the hard working week and then the Friday night opening of the first beer.
But I think it's not necessarily offset. It's not a deferred gratification because that's quite reasonable, isn't it? You know, it's in the hard work of the week itself. There's a certain enjoyment within the suffering itself, and it's not a pleasurable thing, but it's something that there's an economy of satisfaction there.
And
in
what
the
is that
pain itself?
So to get to the bottom of this, Richard, what's that based upon? So let's say there's no Friday night at the end of the week and you just carry on working Saturday and Sunday. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you just keep going, like in Squid Games.
Yeah.
What would that be? What would that sense of displeasured satisfaction be based upon?
It's not pleasure. It's almost the opposite. It's an enjoyment in the pain.
In actual pain. What would that satisfaction be based upon?
Well, sorry, John.
I was going to say, is it all the characters in Squid Game are there because they're in debt, largely?
Yeah.
Or they've got in problems with the main character.
Ji-hun.
He's not very nice at the beginning. You don't really like him. He's basically living off his mother.
He nicked off his mum, yeah.
He's a dreadful sort of sponger, really. And you get a brief insight into that he may not be as bad as that. When the guy at the station at the beginning says to him, well, you know, you once had a good job and you lost it and then you tried to run another business. So capitalism, as it were, the market has treated him badly. But now he's not a nice character at all. Is it possible that people submit themselves to pain in our as a means of punishing themselves for their own perceived, I don't know, privilege or failures? The sort of masochism of those people like the old Thomas More, who used to walk around with a hair shirt and a stone in his shoe and, you know, a constant...
Yeah, guilt.
I work every day because ultimately I know that I'm...
Because I don't deserve anything. I don't deserve my humanity.
Fear of not deserving it. I don't know. Maybe I'm going too far.
Richard, is that what you're saying? That might be what this sense of, you know, internalized masochistic approach to life might be based upon. Is that what you're saying?
Within Squid Games or in general?
I mean, in general, yes. Is that what you're saying? It might be based upon people not feeling like they deserve a proper human experience and they just want to embrace the system. So it's a very psychological.
I think it's psychological, yeah. I mean, I can only go on that it's kind of, it's hardwired into us. And in Lacanian sense, it's the real, isn't it? It's part of the real. And you can't, you know, you can only sort of experience its effects. But I always found it was an interesting thing when I read about this in relationship to Nazis, and it was a critique I'd read of, it was a kind of commentary on the Banality of Evil book on Eichmann, and saying within that it wasn't just a banality of evil, it wasn't just cogs in a machine, that there was a level of enjoyment that was going on the whole time in the ordering of papers, in the uniforms themselves, in the very bureaucratic structure itself. There was a satisfaction in carrying out that kind of regime. And I think most people have that because it's like we said last week, the alternative is absolute freedom, which is terrifying for people, you know, to have absolute, you know, anything. So there is a self-imposed structure. You know, you see it every day. You know, people, I mean, you know, you go on a certain diet or an exercise regime, or I'm going to read this amount every day, or I'm going to exercise, or whatever they're going to do. You know,
podcasts. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But there's an element of pain within that, isn't there? There's self-imposed.
Is that the kind of Fight Club idea? The seeking violence in order to find some meaning and experience?
There would be elements of that within that. I think the Fight Club argument, I mean, isn't that more a critique of, again, the faith, the meaninglessness of the meaninglessness. Modern capitalist kind of existence. Yeah.
Because personal sacrifice will give a degree of meaning, even if it's absent other aspects of your life.
Be in the enjoyment in the sacrifice, not the sacrifice. The ethics of the sacrifice are almost irrelevant. It's in the meaning. It's meaning within the carrying out of it itself. It's a kind of...
So again, is it satisfaction or enjoyment?
It would be, you know, it's a psychoanalytic enjoyment, which is an enjoyment in pain, almost pain, yes. An enjoyment in suffering. You know, in the past, I've had ridiculous kind of exercise regimes I've carried out and dietary stuff I've done in the past, you know, and you impose those things on yourself. And there's a strange satisfaction that goes along with the torturing of yourself in that sense. It's that's what it is. It's the same as when you're a kid at school and, we said, you know, the dinner ladies took everything so seriously and the rules and the you can do this, you can't run here, you can't do that. And it's an enjoyment within the rules themselves. And I didn't know within Squid Games, probably stretching it a little bit, but for the main sort of the guy with the mask on and everything else says, it's not just the carrying out of rules and the laws. So there was another dimension if you read it using...
Yeah, I'd say, why do they come back to the game? Well, because they're desperate, and because when they go back into the outside world, that vivid colour, I mean, it's represent this world of the game is incredibly vivid. It's full of bright, contrasting colours. It's their world is, you know, grey and tawdry and face up to their debts. This is escape from that. But also, the old man at the end says, well, I did this because I was coming towards the end of my life, got a brain tumor, and I thought I want to live and experience things. So yeah. I entered into the game myself. Well, in that sense, that's saying the same thing, isn't it? The kind of Fight Club idea of seeking pain.
That's interesting.
In order to experience
to feel alive,
being alive. Yeah, yeah, being alive. Yeah,
yeah.
My mum has just said, is it so people can feel something? So they need the pain just to feel that, when everything is numb and dead in the system, and second rate, that the actual rules, whether it's Squid Game or reality, is offering some opportunity to feel. Is that what you're saying, Richard?
Yeah,
that's a very good point. Now that Daniel, you say to your mum, there's a discussion in the book Conversations with Zizek, with Glyn Daly and Zizek, and they talk about just that. And right. in that, they use the example of cutters. They use the example of extreme sports, where there's a desire to try and feel again, to have some excessive thing that's not being offered to them in the day-to-day constraints.
What you're saying, Rich, is that going back to the Squid Games and possibly a day-to-day life in a capitalist society, let's say the two things are equal, that people just go along with the system and they get a satisfaction through the pain that the system produces because it makes them feel something. Is that the end result? Is that what you're saying?
No, sorry, say again.
So it's either Squid Games or a day-to-day life in a capitalist society. Let's take the two things as equal. People go along with the system so that they can feel something. And they get a sense of satisfaction from that feeling, even though it's quite painful and possibly masochistic.
Yeah, I don't think it's a driving force. I don't think it's part of. I just feel that there is a dimension there. There's a dimension there of not just.
I suppose everyone remembers what it's like to feel alive, because obviously if they've had a fairly acceptable childhood, they'd remember what that felt like. Mm. And as life moves on, everything, like the Pink Floyd song, everything gets comfortably numb. So to feel alive, they go along with the system that is very masochistic, gives them a sense of pain. But it's that sense of pain that makes them feel alive, ironically. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, slightly. I mean, there is definitely an element of what keeps a system like that continuing to exist. Like I say, if you're taking, a hospital, I don't know, we've all worked in education. So within an educational setting, the reason that system keeps functioning, even though it's largely broken, is because at a bureaucratic level, people continue to get into it and point in enjoyment within the day-to-day bureaucratic procedure itself, just in doing that. I don't know about the arguments around feeling again. So what do they call it? Like a experience of the real the real itself, the real being in a Lacanian sense, the real to experience that again. I think that would be a rupture from that, wouldn't it? It would be a break from that almost.
So I don't know what this is based on. Why would someone just keep replicating a kind of, mediocre, unsatisfying existence, like you talk about, the kind of the obsession with data in schools and people getting excited about it when they know it's so far from what schools are supposed to do, which is supposed to be schools rather than just measure numbers.
Because there's an enjoyment within that, Dan. There's an enjoyment with the system itself work, and it's
people just, not seeing themselves as individuals. It's just there's an enjoyment in propping up the system because it's always been. I see. Okay.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of possible enjoyments there. Not only the sort of the masochism that we talked about earlier, the possible, paying for some underlying guilt, privilege in a consumer society. There's also the ability to offload any morality, really. I'm part of the system, not me. That's what Eichmann said at his trial. In a sense, he said, I'm just obeying orders. That classic, I was just a cog in the wheel. I was very pleased to be doing a good job,
And that's the point.
Bad stuff well. They say, well, at least I'm doing it well. It may be bad,
Richard, what are you going to say?
I was just going to say it's the pleasure in doing the job itself, the pleasure in, even though you know it's causing you pain, or it's in the Eichmann argument. Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's in the procedure itself, your engagement in the procedure, where you are taking a fetishized view of like shiny buttons and paperwork in order and all this kind of thing.
Talking of banality, fetishization and such like.
Yeah.
I'm going to name drop my one celebrity meeting. You know this, don't you? That I was once interviewed at Camden Job Centre, not Camden, Kentish Town Job Centre, by Dennis Nielsen, the serial
killer. Oh, right. Yes.
Serial killer. Well,
and you survived.
I know, yeah.
You didn't go back to his flat for a cup of tea, John. Yeah.
I didn't meet him in a gay bar on the Camden High Street. I met him in the Kentish Town Job Centre, so where he's doing a perfectly good job. But for whatever reason, he killed people, cut them up, boiled their heads in pots on the stove, flushed their entrails down the toilet and such like. And when interviewed about this, he's like Eichmann. He's a completely banal character. He just, he didn't know why he did it. He just did it. And it was all about clearing up afterwards. And he was quite pleased to have disposed of them. And when the police found him, he was very helpful and polite.
Yeah.
But we're talking about psychopathy there, or normality. And I think what Richard's saying is this is a sense of terrifying normality.
Yeah, I would say, but also to go back to our original concept of the critique of capitalism is the latent violence within capitalism. So to retread that idea, there's all sorts of ways in which people will quite methodically carry out the building of atomic weapons or the maintaining of atomic weapons silos, knowing that mass murder is what their purpose is, or that in warfare people will carry out very efficiently the destruction of perfect strangers for wars they don't really know why they're happening. There's all sorts of ways in which we are able to easily defer or offload our own moral responsibility, to an alarming extent.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what's. I mean, I know that's not what you're saying, Richard. That's different. But
no, I mean the point with the made with the enjoyment. I don't make it like a big thing. It's not a motivational. It's just one part. It wasn't with the Eichmann argument. It wasn't just that he was a bureaucrat. I'm just doing exactly what I'm told. I'm not a factor in this. I'm just a cog in the machine. It wasn't just that. There was that, but there was also a dimension of enjoyment in the facilitation of the machine itself.
Well, I mean,
of those things working efficiently, and it's that's chink in the armor would be that,
I mean, going back to when I went to Auschwitz, the stories of Auschwitz, you thought to yourself, well, if they were simply these sort of dull witted bureaucrats who'd found themselves exercising something for which they'd given away all their moral judgment, why were they so sadistic? And then the stories that come out in Auschwitz are of sadism. I mean, literally, they enjoy mocking, humiliating, tricking, and laughing about it, enjoying the killing. Whereas in Squid Game, in a way, the guards don't appear to do any of that. It's very, very bureaucratic, the violence in Squid Game. Very functional.
Very dehumanized.
Yeah, they're tremendously so it isn't suggesting these people are getting much pleasure, the guards much pleasure.
No.
The only people who are getting any kind of pleasure are they the so-called VIPs. Just I want to say something. The so-called VIPs. It struck me that a couple of things about them. One is, we talked about Orientalism. I thought that's a nice example of Occidentalism. So in this Korean world, when the really ghastly, pervy, nasty old bad guys show up, or the customers for this sadistic enterprise, they're all Westerners, and they are sort of fleshy white. it reminds me of the kind of early cartoons that you saw, cartoon drawings that the Japanese made of Westerners when they first encountered Westerners in
the anime drawings
in the 18th century. Yeah, those early drawings. Yeah, and the Westerners all pale and long-nosed and rather porcine characters. Rather, compare, and actually I got that in the film actually, when he takes his mask off, this tubby white bloke, I thought, you know, you're not standing out very well. Actually, most of the other actors are Korean models and such like, but never mind. You know, he doesn't physically, the Westerner doesn't hold up very well.
Very badly acted. Was that deliberate, do you think? The acting by the VIPs was bad.
You're right. It's all.
I thought that might have been deliberate by the directors to make a point about the nature of these characters.
Yes, it was like
they're just not real. They can't even be acted.
And I wondered if it was like they were sort of very, very odd sort of statements and crude jokes to each other and laughing. Yeah, and they were given terrible dialogue. As you say, quite dreadfully written dialogue.
Terrible dialogue, yeah.
Yeah.
To the point, makes the point that they're not saying anything at all because they're just empty shells.
Yes. And sexual ambivalence and perversion and villainy, you know. It's a bit like, you know, when you're going to portray, if you're going to get an actor to portray Caligula, you go, oh, well, he's obviously going to be a bit sexually ambiguous. He's going to be the pervy emperor. He's not going to be banal in any way. He's going to be sort of flicking a cat and sort of, you know, there's something.
Because if you're talking about an 8-hour piece of artistic endeavor, it's tough. Whereas if you've got just a chapter to deal with of text, you can talk about it much more neatly.
And each of us have a slightly different perspective of what
which is good.
I really enjoyed that though.
Yeah, I don't know what it's going to sound like. Have you stopped recording, John, by the way?
No, I'm still recording. I cut all this end bit out if we talk about, you know.
Okay, but
we'll get it out.
It's tougher than dealing with just a straightforward philosopher or a text when you're dealing with a piece of contemporary TV.
Yes.
It's tough.
Really good, though. Yeah. I mean, we should think of it. Why don't we, we could do a part two to this. And I've not seen... Parasite yet, but maybe we could do a sort of.
I'll just look at Parasite again. Parasite's very good. Yeah, I'll look at it again. I didn't realize how good it was.
What do you think? I mean, is it? I've not seen it. Is it one we'd get a conversation out of? Do you think?
It's very similar themes. Very, isn't it, John?
Yeah, it's
very similar.
It's better. It's in a way. It's altogether more adept.
It's slicker, isn't it? Yeah,
it's slicker and cleverer, but it's basically there's a fair amount of violence. There's violence, there's class, there's disparities, there's moral ambiguity, there's questions of you know, who are the parasites, all that stuff.
And it's also based in reality as well, sort of. It's not got a fictional aspect. It's just
I've got to go, guys. Let's brilliant to speak to you. We'll have as soon as we can get and do another one, let me know and we'll jump on that.
I'll get Plato out as soon as possible.
You have been listening to the Spinoza Triad with Dr. Richard Miller, Dan Rowlands and myself, John Gibbs. If you liked our discussion and you enjoyed listening to us explore the Squid Game, please share us on social media. Otherwise, join us next time when we think about other philosophical ways of understanding the world around us, or just talk.